Okay. In okay, so we are at the very, very end of Sefer Bereshit. Sefer Bereshit is about, as a whole book, it's about brothers that don't get along, and the younger brother always wins. My older brother once heard me say that. He didn't like that so much. But it's certainly right anyway. And I think that there are some, a couple of leftover strands that we still either need to or it's worthwhile trying to contemplate, to deal with, to look at. And then there's a subtext that just sort of flows throughout Rashi in this week's parsha, and that subtext is, for lack of a better term, I'll call it right now, Yaakov's confusion. Yaakov's loss of clairvoyance, Yaakov's loss of nevuah. And as far as, again, I recall right now three times that Rashi says it. It may be more, but on the other hand, there are certain times that Rashi speaks about Yaakov being able to see things far off into the future as well. The other thing which is very strange is our insistence that we have a bunch of brachot, where most of them don't sound very much like brachot. Most of them sound like actually anything but brachot. So let's begin in the beginning. The first comment, which Rashi says right in the very beginning, Vayichi Yaakov Eretz Yitzrayim Shva Asrei Shana, so Yaakov lives a total of X amount of years. So Rashi over here writes, Lama Parsha Zus Stuma. Why is this Parsha sealed? Is it closed? What he means by that is, if you look visually at all the other Parshot in the Torah, when the Parsha begins, it either begins at a new line, new paragraph, or at least you have a space, either Petucha or Stuma, but you never have a Parsha, just it's literally the next word. And over here, Parshat Vayechi begins that way. You'll always notice that the Baal Koreh, when it comes to Vayechi, there will be a pause of around 3-4 seconds before they start the Kriya, because you just have to look for it, yeah. Say that again? The Gemara already tells us that there was a machlokes between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, between what we call the triennial cycle and the yearly cycle. So presumably the yearly cycle that they had was this cycle with the way it's broken up. So that would go all the way back at least to the time of the Gemara. Even though admittedly we never see in the Gemara the names that we have of the parsha that we have. But I would say with fair degree of confidence that they were divided where they are. But for that matter, Medrash Rabbah, or Breishis Rabbah, which is pretty old, does point it out over here. This is not Rashi saying it by himself. This is really Rashi saying this based upon Medrash Rabbah, which is pointing out this Parsha is the one which is different. And by the way, I did waste some time earlier in the week, and I did look at every other Parsha in the Torah just to make sure that this was in fact the case. And it is. Somebody has to do that, right? So Rashi writes two things. Lefisha, right, Lama Parsha Zus Stuma, Lefisha Kevin Shenifta Yaakov Avinu Nistabu Enein V'Libon Sheyisrael Mitzarat HaShiabud. That there's something constricting which is taking place, there's something closed. So Rashi's pointing at the constriction in terms of the slavery which is about to begin. Because now it begins. Even though, if according to most opinions, they were in Egypt for a period of 210 years, but they were only slaves for 86 years. Which means at which point exactly does the real Shiabud begin? I think that there's a little time still. Dover Acher, Rashi then gives a second interpretation. Shabikesh Lagalot etaketz levanav v'nistam mimenu. And Rashi says, Bereshit Rabbah, that comes from Bereshit. This, I assume, I don't know if Rashi wrote, whoever stuck in the source, that Yaakov wanted to reveal the kates to his children, the end of days, what's going to happen, v'nistam imenu, which means it was shut down. So here's one place that Rashi says it. Although, let's admit for a second, the impetus for Rashi's interpretation in this case is not anything in the words. The impetus is actually the way that we divide the parshiyot, which is just very interesting for him to use that as something which concerns him, because again, it's a little out of the ordinary, and at risk of being attacked, I would call this more homiletics than I would call this actually parshanut. Don't ask me for the difference between the two, but this is it. It does seem a little strange, and I think the major reason Rashi's saying this is because he is going to come back and say this again. It's not just over here. There is something textual, something in the words itself, which gets Rashi to say this. Excuse me? Not here. I don't see anything right here that would have gotten him to say it. Okay, he summons Yosef in. We actually have a couple of these occurrences, so let's take a look. Going to Perek Memchet. The first part is concerned where he'll be buried. Perek Memchet. Yaakov is already getting close to death, so Yosef is told this, and he goes takes his children with him. By the way, what do they not say to them? They don't say that Menashe and Ephraim are coming. Say, so he straightens himself out, and perhaps out of respect for Yosef. Vayomi Yaakov Yosef kel shakai nirei lai beluzver etzkanan v'erechoti vayomer elai nimer ficha v'viticha v'naticha l'kal amim v'natita et ha'aretz hazot lazarecha chorecha chazat olam. Va'ata, and this is crucial, shnei v'necha ha'nolodim l'cha be'eretz Mitzrayim ad bui alecha Mitzrayim lihem Ephraim v'menashe k'ruvin shimun yu'li. So, as far as we can tell, what Yaakov is doing right now is he's giving out the Bechorah. I mean, just like, well, let's not compare right now. Yaakov has 12 children. Of the 12 children, he has 4 children who are firstborns. Right? Of his four firstborns... one of them is the one that he really would prefer, because that's the only one he ever wanted to marry, and that's obviously Yosef from Rachel. Who are the other firstborn sons? Reuven? Right. So it's interesting that who are the ones who want to stay out of the land of Israel? Reuben and Gad, which means if I go look, is there anything in common with the two of them have? So it may be a feeling of firstborns who have been displaced. And it's interesting that afterwards, who then is thrown into the mix? Chatzi Menashe, which then may also, by the way, have been displaced on some level, but they're also thrown into it. So I'm saying, when you notice those three tribes have something in common, you have to pay attention to it. The Arizal has a crazy, crazy insight, which has to do with genetics, which I'm not going to talk about. Yeah. Look it up. Don't bother me. Why ask me questions of what it's written in the Chumash? Okay. So I said, just to realize what's going on over here. So by virtue of the fact that he's giving this bracha to Yosef, giving him two portions, because that's really what's happening. He's saying that Ephraim and Menashe will be to me like Reuven and Shimon. So what's he saying? That Yosef doesn't get one portion, Yosef gets a double portion. So therefore, there really is no such thing as the area in Eretz Yisrael of Yosef. What we have is Ephraim and Menashe. They end up getting a double portion. Okay. He then goes into this whole side discussion about burial. And then Pasuk Yud. V'nei Yisrael kovdu mezoken lo yuchal arot. Sorry. I want to go before that a little bit. Pasuk Chet. Vayar Yisrael b'nei Yosef, vayomer mi'ela. He sees the children of Yosef and he says, who are they? Now, give me a possible interpretation why he doesn't know who they are. So first, as I've already set it up for you, that he doesn't actually know that they're coming. So they're not coming, so who are they? But that's also a little strange. Give me another reason. Yeah? The Targum Yonatan understands the question that way.
Like, where they marry yourself?
V'chama Yisrael yat binoy de Yosef, or miman it yaldulach elon. Who gave birth to these kids? Exactly the way that you understood the question, that's how the Targum Yonasan understands the question. Of course, according to the wonderful Midrashim that we have, who is she? She's Dina's daughter, which then also sets up a wonderful parallel. Dina ends up getting somewhat isolated and pushed away and outside of the family. She has a child who then is not appropriate to stay in the Jewish people and gets sent away. That child who gets sent away ends up merging with Yosef, who gets sent away. So we have the rejected part of the family coming together, and then, but of course, that's an unbelievable midrash to come and say that this is really Dina's son, a daughter. So it is quite interesting. On the other hand, who is Yosef's father-in-law? Just look at parallels. Who is Yosef's father-in-law? Who's Yosef's father-in-law? No. Potiphera, but what does it say? Kohen. Kohen, which means he's some kind of... Now, you'll have to figure out what the Kohen means there. Who else marries the daughter of a Kohen?
Moshe.
So, again, there is something interesting about a comparison between Yosef and Moshe. And the fact they both choose not to marry just regular girls, as it were, but they marry the daughters of some kind of Kohen, whatever the word Kohen means. Kohen could mean leader, it could be religious leader. So you say, you know, which one is better and which is worse. I'll leave that to you to decide. But I'm saying there is something interesting. Of course, you know, Rashi and other places, you know, Chazal generally, they work with what we can call a theory of conservation of characters, and therefore Potiphar sounds like Potiphar. It's the same person and so on, but that's not the easiest thing to say in terms of Shai. Dina marries lots of people. I don't want to say Dina gets around, because that's not going to sound good. But because there is this whole attempt to figure out who Dina ends up marrying. Yeah.
How serious was that point? How much
is
the joke?
Which joke? I was totally serious about that. Because I'll work with that principle. No, Dina's daughter. Dina's daughter, which was the product of the relationship with Shem, ends up marrying Yosef. That's they claim that she's adopted. It's very difficult to say that. But anyway, yeah. Why would you say that? Before Matan Torah, it's hard to be a mamzer. I mean, if I'm worried about mamzer, I'd be far more concerned with a lot of other people. Like saying each one of the Shvatim had twin sisters who they married. I mean, I'd be more concerned with that. Yeah? Right. Okay. Let's continue. So, any other interpretations when he says, "Yeah"? Ah, he can't see because it's right afterwards. Right, Eini Yaakov. Right, he can't see. What's another interpretation you don't want to say? Yeah.
That he was going to tell Yosef right then, like the end of it. Like, oh yeah,
Well, that's going to come later still. Well, what's the other? What's the other part? Hold on to that. We'll come back to the Rashi in a second. What else? Okay. No, you could say pshat. That they're dressed like Egyptians. Are you afraid to say that? He looks at these. Who are these assimilated kids? What is Yosef's answer to him? Vayom Yosef viv b'nai heim asher natan li elokim bazeh. These are my children who were born over here. That's why they look us. You don't like that? It's pshat. That bothers you? I would have asked that question as well. The Malbim says it. By the way, I looked for it. I knew somebody had to say it. I was hoping someone would. But the Malbim does say it. Vayar Yosef, Malbushei ha'ivrim hayu mishunim mi'malbushei ha'mitzrim, v'yosef she'a korv l'malchus, v'chein banav ha'yulubshim ki'malbushei sarei mitzrayim. He says they were dressed like Egyptians, so therefore he was very surprised looking around. Who are these Egyptian kids? So, by the way, this, in terms of pshat, is not so bad in terms of the next pasuk. Right? These are my kids that God gave me here in this place. This is what happens when you raise kids in America. Look at you. Yeah. I don't know what to assume. I don't know what to say. Yaakov's been here for, if this is really close to death, he's been here for 17 years. Right? There's this nice parallel. Yosef spent 17 years with his father, and then right until he was taken away, and now he has less 17 years. So I don't know what to say about that. What I do know is that he doesn't recognize them. What did we suggest? One possibility is because he didn't know they were coming. Now that's real good in terms of pshat also, right? Do you all see why that's good in terms of pshat? Because it says, Yosef is coming, Yosef is here, right? Summoned Yosef, never knew that they were there. So who are them? Oh, those are your kids, fine. Other thing that I said is real good in terms of pshat is maybe they would dress differently, and therefore Yosef's response makes more sense. Anything else that you like? Well, that was it. What? That he, or you can say he couldn't see. He couldn't see at this point. So that's also very good, yeah.
Two.
Okay, let me pay attention then. Yeah. Right? Okay, so maybe it's more of a rhetorical question. Who are these? It's not a serious question. But anyway, second.
Second, Malvin said that they were just like Egyptian Syrian.
Yes.
So again, he knew that Yosef was a...
So you're arguing with Malvin?
1 second.
Okay, anyway, I'm sorry. But I understand. I'm just suggesting these as different types of possibilities as to who are you? From where? What? Ah, so that's what you're doing here. So I have to say something interesting then. I wasn't going to. Okay. We were trying to learn, so that was also important. Okay, so then we'll have to try to say something else then. Okay, what about Rashi? All of you who want to tell, so what does Rashi say? Let's look at that Rashi and let's try to understand the Rashi. Pasachet, Vayar Yisrael b'nei Yosef, Bikesh levarcham v'nistalkash chinah mimenu. He wanted to give them a bracha, but suddenly his... What does that mean exactly? V'nistalkash chinah mimenu. So, okay, the way that I'll translate it is that the Shekhinah, or Yosef's ability to have clairvoyance, dissipated. It disappeared. Yosef, sorry, Yaakov's. Lefisha atid yiravam v'achav letzeit mi'efrayim v'yehu v'nav mi'menashe. That these really bad characters were going to come out in the future. Now, I want to explain this, because this, I think, is very important, even though it's like one little pasuk over here. I do want to explain this, and we'll see how much time this takes us. But this is really quite important. One of the things that we've seen in the last couple of weeks, over and over again, is that every single person who meets Yosef immediately sees his greatness. The only group of people who cannot see his greatness is his brothers. They're the only ones who don't see it. Everybody else sees it immediately. Yes or no? Right. Now, second point, which I did not say clearly, but I do want to say clearly now. The brothers seem to think that Yosef has this false airs of grandeur about him. He has delusions of grandeur about him. Were you going to bow down to you? What's the answer? Yes, you're going to bow down to him, right? So there is something confused about the way Yosef sees the world. Have you ever heard that it says that they put him on trial because he was married by Malchut? Yes, you've all heard this? Find me the source. I can't find it. If you can find it, I'll be very happy. I can't find it. The earliest I could find was L'Shlo HaKadosh said it. I can't find it in any primary source. But I'm not saying it's not there. I'm just saying I looked and I can't find it. But there are other things in Chazal which are close to this, but not as direct and as clear as that. I can't find such a Medrash. There are other things that people claim are in Medrash that are not necessarily there. Anyway. But I want to point something out. So the brothers see Yosef as being He wants to take over. On the other hand, Yehuda is supposed to take over. And see, the reason why that's not such a bad thing to say is that as we follow all the way through the next couple of parashiyot, Yehuda is the one who wins. Yehuda is the one who's going to be anointed. Yehuda is going to become king. Yehuda being king is already, that's really the one thing that we really have a clear sense of Yaakov saying. The serpent will, right, not the serpent, the scepter will not depart from the hands of Yehuda. Yehuda is king. Yehuda's in charge. This is the way it's going to work out. So Yosef therefore loses if there really is this competition between the two. On the other hand, can you note something else? Yosef, in every place, right, he always rises to the top, right? Every place he goes, except for one thing. He's always number two. He's never number one in any place that he is. He's number two to Yaakov, right? That's easy. He's number two to Potiphar. He's number two to the guy in the prison. He's number two to Paro. Yosef is never number one. Yosef is always the one who's the second in charge. If that's the case, even if Yehuda is supposed to become king, so who's better than Yosef to give the keys? You'll open up in the morning, you'll shut it down at night, you run the company for me. Is there anybody, again, I'm being very serious about this, is there anybody in Tanakh who'd rather you'll be the chairman of the board, right? He'll be your CEO, he's running the company for you, or whatever title you want to give him. Yosef is exceedingly competent. But again, what's my point? As far as Yosef having these designs on the Malchut, don't you see he's always number two, he's never number one? Yes? So who do I think really does see that clearly? I think Yaakov sees that. I think Yaakov sees that very, very clearly. I think Yaakov sees it all the way through. Even when he gives him the... I think. Yeah.
I've been having an instance in Tanakh where someone from Yosef is number one.
Yeah.
Meaning Shaul doesn't become number one. And it's not that Yaakov...
No, says, who?
Shaul.
Binyamin.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But my question being that Yaakov doesn't say that Judah's going to be king. He says Judah's never not going to be king.
It's even better. It's even better.
It's worse because he is king, but there's one instance where he's not.
Okay. So hold on to that. It's not you're going in the right direction with this. It could be anybody before is not really the king. Look, Moshe Rabbeinu also may have been a king, but the difference is that there's different types of kings. There's a king that begins a kingship where it continues. We're automatically his son and then his grandson and so on, which means it's true that other people can have leadership roles, but nobody else has a continuing kingship. And that's what Yehuda has. Okay, let's get back to a second to where I was going with this. Rashi just now said it to us. What does Yaakov now see which shocks him? I just want to focus on one. He sees Yeravam. So who is Yeravam? I mean, you learn things like Navi, or we don't know who this was. Excuse me?
He goes off the road.
Okay, what else? Meaning you have a son of Shlomo who's sinning, and you need there to be some type of alternative, which is going to be temporary. He goes and takes a temporary situation, totally exploits it, does it in a way which is so bizarre and so sick. I mean, to the point of not even using one Egel Hazav, taking two. Right, and putting borders practically, not letting people be all the regular Yerushalayim, creating another holiday in the month of Cheshvan, a fake holiday that people can go and serve God someplace else or serve whatever it was someplace else, which means Yeravam. But there's another point to it. This is really the breakdown between what eventually becomes Malchut Yehuda and Malchut Yisrael. But what's interesting is that the Malchut Yisrael ends up gathering more and more followers to the point that they have most of them, and Yehuda now is left with very few, ironically left with Binyamin, but left with very, very few. So now, if you're going to look back at this Rashi, and Yaakov sees in the future, and he sees certain things coming out of Yosef that he never suspected, but what is it that he sees? Somebody who's not happy to be number two. By the way, it's interesting because Yeravam also was originally an advisor. He sees somebody who's not happy to be number two, had enough being number two. What happens when you have somebody who's number two long enough time? They're sitting there and say, hold it, I do all the hard work, I do all the heavy lifting, I'm the one who should be in charge. Right? Why does he get all the glory? Is that a good point? And then he says, I'm going to take over. which means this part of him he never sees. And I want to point out a Gemara. It's in Sanhedrin on Daf Kuf Bet. It says, Amar Rabbi Abba, and we're just jumping in the real middle of it. Acher shetavsu HaKadosh Baruch Hu liyeravim bivigdo. It says that God grabs Yeravim by his clothing, v'amar lo, and he says, Chazor b'cha, come back and do tshuva. And what will happen if you do tshuva, Yeravim? V'ani v'ata uben Yishai nitayel b'gan Eden. By the way, that's a pretty good group. I don't know, you guys go on Teolim. It's a nice place. I don't know exactly where it is, but it sounds like a nice place to do Teol. I'm sure that there's Mayanot and whatever there, right? So what does he ask? Yeravim says, Mi Barosh, who's first? Amarlo, God says, Ben Yishai Barosh. Ihachi, if that's the case, Lo Ba'ina, no thank you. This Gemara is unbelievable. And by the way, did you catch what's really interesting in it, or you didn't catch it? Okay. Okay. So you all missed what's interesting, but okay, that's okay. So you still need me. We'll see, maybe by next week be different. But okay, a couple things. One, this question of who's first, that screams out of this text. Which means the idea that Yeravim is not willing to be number two, that is this negative part of Yosef, which... What? That's the negative part of Yosef, which at some point emerges. This is perhaps something which the brothers always saw. By the way, it never comes out in Yosef, but they see this, but it comes out in the future. That's what they're noticing. Yaakov, for his part, he sees Yosef as always being the person who's number two. And again, everybody sees immediately his greatness, but the brothers see something else. The brothers see this possibility within Yosef of not being satisfied at some point, of wanting to go beyond where he should be and wanting to take over. I'm saying that's one thing that screams out of this Gemara. Now, even the question is an inappropriate question. Do you all realize that? If you're with God and Ben Yishai, do you realize who's first is an inappropriate question? Shut up. You're with God and Ben Yishai. Be quiet. Be quiet. Just sort of go with the flow. But I'm saying that he had to ask that question itself is telling you something. Okay, that's one thing. What else did you not notice? Should I read it again? Do you feel challenged yet or no? What?
One more time.
Amar bi Abba. Acher shetafsu HaKadosh Baruch Hu liyeravim bivigdo v'amar lar chazor b'cha. Grabs him. Come back. Vaniva tov ben Yishai natayel began Eden. Amalo mi barosh. Amalo ben Yishai barosh. Ihachi lo ba'ina. So what do you all miss? Grabs by the clothing. That remind you of anything? Okay. First of all, you have David and whatever, the whole thing. No, but it's not the same. It's not tafsu. It's the exact language which is used, except the masculine versus the feminine. It's the exact language which is used by Eshet Potiphar. Which also, you know, leads us to a question. So I said we're going backwards, leftover strands over here. Listen to the pasuk. V'yehi kedabro Yosef yom yom, v'lo shema eleha, l'shkav etzla uliotima. Every single day she's working on him, every single day she's hitting on him. V'yehi kayom hazeh v'yavo baita l'asot melachto. One day he goes in to do his melacha. Now, you know that there's a machloket in the Gemara about this, right? What's the machloket? Machloket Rav and Shmuel. Okay, good. Okay, now continue. The machloket is whether he went in innocently or whether he went in not so innocently. When I read the pasuk, tell me which one sounds better, that it's innocent or not. Did you hear the emphasis over there? That day, and nobody's there, and he goes in, and nobody's around. Vatitpsehu bivigdo. And she grabs him by his clothing. Now, there's another thing over here which also screams out that, yeah, maybe have a little bit of sensitivity. And what is that? The word beged. What is the root of the word beged? Bagad, which means? Betrayal. So is it she grabs him by his clothing, or she grabs him by his betrayal? But by the way, why is clothing connected to betrayal? That goes all the way back to Gan Eden, right? It goes all the way back. Man was. I never told you this. I gave a talk once about eating meat and how l'tavat nafsho and how it satisfies your soul and something which is good for you. You should eat meat. Meat is good for you. And I get an email from this guy who says that he's the head of the World Jewish Organization of Jewish Vegetarians. And he says to me, and he writes to me, he goes, he sent me his book, and he says, don't you think that the highest level of man is to be a vegetarian? Because Adam Arishan was a vegetarian. So I wrote back to him. He also walked around naked. Like, what's your point? It has nothing to do with us today. But the idea that we put clothing on, and the word beged has within its root begida, is interesting. How do you say coat? Mi'il. What's there? You have mi'ila, ma'al, which means that there is something there about clothing which sometimes may point towards some type of rebellion. Now, you could tell me it's for a whole other reason, is that when you put on clothing, that itself sometimes can be an unbelievable lie. Right, you put on clothing which isn't you. You put on clothing which you're trying to convey something which is not true. Clothing is a wonderful way to lie. Yes, you hear that? But excuse me. Adam's first clothing that he puts on represents a betrayal that he ate from the Eitz HaDaat Tov V'Ra, and he realized that he's naked. That's exactly what God says to him. Yeah. So over here, I'm saying the language is so interesting that God grabs Yeruvim by his clothing is the same language as she grabbed Yosef by the clothing. And again, I'm saying there may be this interesting subtext of clothing somehow being related to treachery, to bigida. Which means, and you know what, maybe I'll even phrase it a little differently. Yosef gets to Egypt. Why he gets to Egypt, you know, because they sold him. Okay, maybe he was innocent, maybe not. Maybe he did something to deserve it, maybe not. But the truth is that after this, he gets thrown into prison. And assuming this is around, he's 17 years old, he gets thrown into prison for the next how many years? Till he's 30. How many years is that? How many? It's a long time. That's part of what Chazal is saying. If he got thrown into, it's one thing to be in charge of Potiphar's house. Another thing, then they get thrown into prison, which is a worse place. So maybe he's being thrown into prison is because of some kind of rebellion which took place. And maybe over here, what this is pointing to is that even though Yosef is really this unbelievably impressive character, there's still something there which is under the surface, which has this ability to come out later. And that's what Chazal are pointing at over there. God grabs him by his begidah. God grabs him by the clothing. Same language used by Eshet Potiphar. Maybe he shouldn't have been in that house. Maybe there was something wrong in that behavior. And over here, when he then comes out and says something which he just shouldn't be saying, mi barosh, so maybe now that's really what Chazal is trying to tell us. There is this other side of Yosef, which Yaakov never sees. Yaakov now sees it for the first time. He wants to, and by the way, it's also interesting. He doesn't see it when he sees Yosef. Where does he see it? By Yosef's offspring. It's what's going to come. It's a toladah. It's going to come from Yosef. It's not the av, it's the toladah. In Yosef itself, it's not there, but maybe it's there in potential. And now for the first time, Yaakov sees it. So I'm just saying, that's really interesting what Chazal are doing in this Gemara, and I would be very tempted to connect it to this Rashi over here that we just now saw. Yeah. So it's interesting that even though he loses, that nonetheless he sees that this is the one who's more capable. So there is this really interesting combination going back and forth. He can't see, but he does see. So he does see, and he says, yeah, the younger one is the one, and therefore he switches the hands. The other thing is the bracha itself. I'll touch that, and then we'll try to move on to the other time that Yaakov loses this ability to see. The bracha itself is that we should bless our children by saying it should be like Ephraim and Menashe. So normally, the experience that most of us have, and I'll say this has been an experience ever since at least Har Sinai, maybe before, is that we always sense that there is this Yiridah HaDarot. You go from one generation to the next, we just feel that we're further and further from Sinai, and that it's just a subsequent generation is not going to be as great as the earlier generation. I mean, once when I was sitting in Rabbi Soloveitchik's shir, he mentioned the Vilna Gaon. And he said the following. He said, "You guys think that I'm so great, you call me the Rav and whatever." That's exactly what he said. He said, "If I were alive when the Vilna Gaon lived, they wouldn't let me clean up the Beis Medrash on Erev Shabbos. I'm not on a high enough level to sweep the floor." Literally, that's what he said. To sweep the floor in the Vilna Gaon's Beis Medrash. By the way, he also stressed that Yehoshua was the one who swept the floors in Moshe Rabbeinu's tent, and that's why he became who he was. But he says, you know, I'm not on that level, because there really is this profound feeling that if you go back one, two, three generations, it's just not the same that it is today. And I think it's a legitimate feeling. The bracha about Ephraim and Menashe, they're like Reuven and Shimon, is that even though they're a generation later, they succeed in having no generation gap. And add one more element to this, despite the fact that they were raised far away from the rest of the quote-unquote Jewish community, that they're raised in Egypt and they're wearing Egyptian clothes, you know, as we raise as a possibility, that despite all this, that they're still spiritually on the same level like Reuven and Shimon, so that's something which becomes very impressive. So basically, what is the bracha we give to our kids when you say Yisimcha L'Kim Chafayim Menashe? The bracha we're giving to them is that there should be no generation gap. There should be no Yerida Hadarot. That they should somehow be able to be exactly on like the previous generation, and we should have a total ability of communicating with them and passing on as if we're on the same level, rather than there being some kind of a, I think it's the opposite of evolution, I think we can call it devolution. Okay, so that seems to be the message. You know the famous story of Yaakov Kamenetsky? I shouldn't tell it to you now. Yeah, go ahead.
So your endorse only applied to like the village or to the leaders, or does it apply to everyone as well? If you go back to like biblical times, like during Nach, the people like were committing sexual morality, committing idolatry, committing basis murder, like all throughout Nach. Today you don't really see it that much. So like when you see it,
today people don't sin anymore.
Differences.
Where you been?
No, but I'm saying it's not as rampant amongst the Jewish community.
Okay, let's go on. Okay. Baruch Hashem. Let's go on. No, look. It is true that there are certain... It is true there are certain sins that aren't... There are certain sins which aren't Jewish minhagim, right? But for the last 1,000 years... By the way, people kill... Because they think they have a reason to kill. I'm not going to bother with this now.
Doesn't it also only refer? Doesn't it refer to the knowledge generally that we're further from our Sinai? So
certainly in terms of knowledge. Again, that's the sense that we have, is that you know, you learn the Rishonim, you learn the Achronim. You're not learning the same books. It's not the same, the Rishonim and the Achronim. Excuse me. Who does? We have more knowledge. Okay. Yeah.
In the future, they shall bless the yep. Ephraim and Menashe. It's not really a blessing, it's more a statement of fact. And then he's saying, like, anything saying, you guys can be famous, like, good job.
Okay. Well, just one second. I don't want to ignore this. You really think that we're greater today than they were, that we know more now?
We have more data. We have more knowledge.
Good. We're standing on their shoulders, but that's what that even that metaphor. We're very little, standing on the shoulders of somebody very big. It's true. We have more books. We have more books. We have more data. We have more information. But our knowledge of them is not as impressive as it was in previous generations. Just what they knew was just so much more impressive. Okay, let's stop with that. Let's try to get back to the last point. We have over here something which I would call a bait and switch, and this is really the main issue, the main reason why this whole thing of Yaakov losing it really comes up. At the beginning of Perek Memtet, we have what's called in business a bait and switch, right? What's a bait and switch? That you advertise one product, they come to buy the product, and it's gone, and they say, okay, I don't have any of that one, but let me sell you this one instead. You advertise a television which will cost... you'll say it's going to cost 500 shekel. You show it's 40 inches, 500 shekel. You show, well, we don't have that one. We have 45 inches for 5,000 shekel. Okay, and they try to convince you to get that one. So that's called a bait and switch. You put some bait and you switch it. Vayikra Yaakov el banav vayomer hesvu vagidalachem et asher yikra etchem b'acharit ha'amim. Come gather together. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen at the end of days. Hikivtsu v'shemu b'nei Yaakov v'shemu Yisrael avichem. Right, more. Come gather. I'm going to tell you. And then, instead of telling them the future, he tells them the past. Reuven, Vichoriata, tells him about how he messed up. Pachas Kamayim, Shimon V'Levi, how they messed up. Which means instead of telling the future, instead of telling the end of days like he says he would, what ends up happening, we have, again, a bait and switch. Again, I think this is a great idea. I'm going to start, you know, advertising lectures. I'm going to reveal what's going to happen at the end of days. So there's only one problem. What's the problem? I'll say, I was about to tell you, but let's read Rashi. What does Rashi say? Bikesh lagalota taket v'nistalka mimenu shchina v'tchil omer dever machirim. He was going to say it, but then he starts saying other things. It means here is where there's textual reason for it. That's why I said in the beginning of the parasha, Rashi says it. It sounds much more like homiletics. Oh, this, you know, there's no space over here. That's not really a textual problem. Here, there's a textual problem. Yaakov says, "Come, I'm going to tell you this," and then he doesn't tell it to them. What happened? So, again, he either accused Yaakov of being the first Jew to have really bad business practices, or you can say that there was over here, he wanted to, and something happened. That's what Chazal say. Now, this idea in Chazal is found in a bunch of different places. It's in Medrash Rabbah, both here and Devarim. It's in the Gemara, in Pesachim. I'm not sure where I'll say it from. And it's different. And it's different in the different places. So I'll start with the Gemara. The Gemara actually was trying to figure out something. The Gemara wants to know why when we say Shema, our minhag is, right, we say Shema Yisrael, Shem HaKen, Shem Echad, then we say Baruch Shem Kavod Malchut Olam Ved. I don't know if any of you ever looked in Sefer Devarim. Lo and behold, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchut Olam Ved is not written there. So it says, hold it, why are we saying it if it's not there in the Chumash? So the Gemara then goes and tells a story. By the way, this story is another example of an Agadah, of a story told right in the Gemara, in the Medrash, that the Rambam brings in the Halacha, in the Mishnah Torah. He brings this story. He brings this as absolute, 100% historical fact. So it says, what happened? Yaakov was on his deathbed. He wanted to reveal. And what happened? He looks around the room. Sorry, he loses his Nevuah. He looks around the room and he says, hold it, maybe there's something wrong over here. The same way that my grandfather Avram had a Yishmael, and my father had an Esav, maybe one of you is not what I think you are. Now, there's actually a wonderful question that could be asked on that. Why in the world did he ever think it would be any different? Why would he think that he wouldn't have a kid who goes, quote-unquote, off the derech? If Avram did, if Yitzhak did, why should he think that, you know, mitato shlema, that when it comes to Yaakov, no, everyone's going to stay together. So quickly on this, the way that it's explained, and this is a very dominant understanding within Kabbalah, the Maharal has it, not everybody nuances it exactly the same way, but basically what you have is some kind of an adoption or adaptation of what today would be called, if you went to Gush, a Hegelian dialectic. But you don't go to Gush, so I can just say it to you a little differently. What it means is that you have thesis, and then you have antithesis, and then you have synthesis. The thesis is Avraham, the antithesis of that is Yitzchak, and then the synthesis is Yaakov. But to make it a little bit more complicated, you need to understand why you need a thesis, antithesis, and then a synthesis. So it goes basically like this. Avraham's main trait is chesed. Chesed is the greatest thing in the world, correct? Should I try again? Chesed is the greatest thing in the world. What's the negative of chesed? That chesed, when it's too much, when there's no limitations, something bad happens. Now, in the language of Chazal, there is a klipa. A klipa would be a counterfeit. Okay, think of it like this. You see a fruit, a beautiful fruit. You see an orange. You look at the orange, right? Somebody told me recently that when his father came to America, he had never seen an orange before. He went to visit somebody, and they gave him an orange. He took a bite of the orange. Didn't know he had to peel it. Never saw one before. So he thought, you bet it. So then the woman gave him a banana. So they took a bite. They didn't, had no idea. So that is actually a great metaphor, because there are times in life that we get confused between the real thing versus the thing that looks like the real thing. And the thing that looks like it's sometimes far more attractive. The orange looks really nice. Don't eat the peel. The peel should be taken off. That's the klipa. The counterfeit of chesed, according to Chazal, as I said, this is found in Kabbalistic books, the counterfeit is Yishmael, who according to the Medrash was guilty of Gilui Arayos. Chesed, I mean, basically what the Medrash says is that he uses chesed as a pickup line. He says, listen, didn't my father tell you should be a balas chesed? You know, you should share everything that you have. And that means chesed needs limitations. So once there's an Avram who teaches the world chesed, and remember, before Avram, you got a really bad neighborhood doing really bad things. Avram comes into a town, people are grabbing at his wife, right? People come into Avram's town, Avram's giving them food. People come into Lot's town, they're grabbing at the guests. People come to Avram's tent, he's bringing them water, bringing them food, bringing them tongue, and bringing them butter. I hope not together. But he's bringing them all of these things. So again, you just look at the difference. Avram is chesed. So total chesed needs limitations. And that's where Yitzchak comes in. Yitzchak is gvura. Yitzchak is strength. In Judaism, what is gvura? Ezehu gibor? Hakovesh Yitzro. Which means, what is real gvura from the Jewish perspective? Self-control. So now you have thesis, antithesis. Once there's a chesed of Avram, you need there to be this Yitzchak to stop it. By the way, on an inner relationship, you have the same thing. Avram has a Sarah. Sarah says, get rid of the kid. Avram doesn't want it. Yitzchak, on the other hand, what kind of wife do you look for Yitzchak? Somebody who's a Baal Chesed. They each also need that inner dynamic within in order to counterbalance. Avram, thesis, Yitzchak, antithesis, chesed, gvura, and then you have Tiferet, beauty, which gathers the best part of both. And that's what Yaakov is. Which means if Yaakov has a deep understanding of this, you don't need there to be more than three avot. That's why you only need three. And that's why Yaakov can say there's a klipa of chesed, and that's Yishmael. There's a klipa of gvura. What's the klipa of gvura? Is Esav, who's a man of violence, a man of strength, a man who wants to capture, a man who wants to kill. So therefore you have thesis, antithesis, klipa, klipa. By the way, now you realize one of the scariest psukim in the whole Torah is which pasuk? When Esav goes and marries into the Yishmael family, it's a merger of the two klipot. It's something which is terribly frightening. I'll put it in today's terms. If the Christian world and the Arab world merges together, so no, where does that leave up? When Obama wants to reach out to Iran and let's make peace over here, so who does that leave on the side suddenly feeling very vulnerable? That pasuk of Yishmael and Esav merging together, that's a very scary pasuk. That's two klipot coming together, two things which are, again, should really be pushed aside. Yaakov, therefore, looks and thinks he's done spiritually what needs to be done, and all of his children now can be Klal Yisrael. So it's a little late if it's not going to work out well. On your deathbed, it's a little late to start working things out. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to, very, very quickly, because I really don't have time to do that, but Rachel and Leah is an accident. When Yaakov takes the brachot, which are designed for Esav, Yaakov then ends up taking Esav's life as well. Which means, you know all those midrashim that Rachel was for Yaakov and Leah was for Esav? That's true. But now Yaakov becomes Yaakov and Esav, and that's really manifest by Yaakov and Yisrael. So once Yaakov is Yaakov and Yisrael, then now there's two sides of Yaakov, that is represented by Leah and by Rachel. And therefore, I once made the mistake of talking about this in the Upper West Side, and there's a singles group, and there was some guy who said, he goes, I know what you mean. Sometimes you need a Rachel, and sometimes you're in the mood for a Leah. I said, that's not what I said. It's not what I said. It's your foolish Shlema. What's your mother's name? Anyway, yeah.
The theory that Yitzchak being all that word, that be why Yaakov is loyal because of old, because it's Yitzchak's tent, and he was all that precious, and can't go out and
It's very nice. And that's exactly the way that you need to start looking at things and thinking them through. Now, Yaakov is on his death, but he looks around and all the kids, and that's it. So what do they say? That's what the Gemara says. They all then say, no. We all believe what you believe. And they say, Shema Yisrael, talking to their father, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Achad. So now, the next part depends on which source you're looking. The Gemara then says, Yaakov says, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus Olam Vayed. Then the Gemara says, so what do? Moshe didn't say it, Yaakov did say it. So should we say it like Yaakov? Should we not say it like Moshe? So what does the Gemara end up with? A compromise. What's the compromise? You say it, but you say it silently. So that's exactly where the quiet Baruch Shem comes from. On the other hand, there are some Midrashim that say that Yaakov said it quietly. So the way the Rav Soloveitchik explained this was, one year he was old, and they decided it would be too hard to teach Gemara, so he taught Shulchan Aruch. He taught Aruch Chaim. We learned from the beginning of Brachos all the way through Hilchos Kriyat Shema and so on. And when we got to Hilchos Kriyat Shema, about Shema, this is what he said. He quoted the Medrash that says that Yaakov said it silently, and he says, what's Pshat? That Yaakov is worried about his kids. They're really not on the outside what they are on the inside, or the other way around. They're not on the inside, what they are on the outside. They look like they're all religious, but it's not there. So they all scream Shema Yisrael out loud. So Yaakov says, that's great, but that's an outward directed. And then he says, quietly, Baruch Shem Kavod Machasol. He says, no, you also need a Kabbalah Sol Machas Shemayim, which is internal. So therefore, when we say Shema, this is how we say Pshat. You say Shema, we have an outward directed Shema Yisrael that we accept there to be one God, but then we also have a quiet one, which is an internal one. So that's the way that he explained it. But as I said, that works well with the Midrash and not that well with the Gemara. Okay. Let me add one or two more elements to this, and I think we can tie it together. There's a very strange Gemara. Sorry. There's a very strange Rashi. Rashi, it's based on the Pasuk, which the Pasuk already has difficulties. The Pasuk says that when Yaakov and Yosef met up, it says that he goes and he embraces him and he cries, but it doesn't say what the other one is doing. So it says that Yosef embraces his father, Yosef cries, but it doesn't know what Yaakov is doing. So there's the famous Rashi. What does Rashi say Yaakov is doing? Yaakov is saying Shema. So now my wife would understand this completely. That, you know, that's what Jews do. Jews need, you know, we always pray at the wrong time, right? You need help in the morning. You got to take, you know, take help the kids. No, we got to go to shul. Got to put the kids to bed at night. No, we got to go to shul. By the way, this is pshat, why Muslims pray 5 times a day, because they have more than one wife. So they need them more, so they have to get out of the house more. Anyway, pshat. But isn't this a little... Yes, I know Yaakov needs to daven, but isn't this a little strange? He needs to daven now, in the middle. He meets Yosef, okay, sorry, got to daven now. It's a little strange. So I'd be tempted to say that no, it's not that he has to say the Shema, that he has to say V'hafta. He feels so much love towards his son right now, so he wants to direct that towards God. He says, what's the weakness in that interpretation? It doesn't say he says V'hafta, it says he says Shema Yisrael. So, Chazal tell us that Yaakov lost his ability to have nevuah on a previous occasion. This was not the first time on his deathbed. It says that when Yosef leaves, he no longer has nevuah. Actually, anybody remember the pasuk when he realizes that Yosef's still alive, what it says? V'tichi ruach Yaakov Avihem. That Yaakov's ruach comes back to life. At that point, he begins to get this ability to see. Now, I could say this in a couple of different ways. I can say maybe the whole time that Yosef was away, he was so sad, and sadness and nevuah doesn't go together. But at the moment that he's reunited with Yosef, it changes, which means I don't know how to explain nevuah properly, but I'm going to give you a mashal, which maybe will help a little bit. At the time, this is years ago, but at this time when it happened, the most exciting moment in motion picture history, again, maybe afterwards were others, but at the time, the most exciting thing was The Wizard of Oz. When they get to Oz, the whole movie till that point was black and white. And when they get to Oz, it becomes color. That's the difference, I think, that we, again, just on our level that we can understand, is that you don't have the vo, everything is black and white. And then suddenly you see things, colors, textures that you never saw before. The world turns color. Yaakov is seeing, he has nevuah for a very long time. He loses it. And I don't know what Alfred Lord Tennyson would have said about this, right? You know what Tennyson said? He says, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved. Okay? Is it better to have nevuah and then lose nevuah than never to have had nevuah? What do you feel like when God's been talking to you, now he doesn't talk to you anymore? Doesn't talk to you for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5. All these years that Yosef is gone, Rashi actually tells us that Yaakov is totally convinced that he's going to hell. His life is a failure. He failed. God doesn't talk to him anymore. His nevuah is shut down. And then when he realizes that Yosef is alive, it comes back. And when he sees Yosef, he says Shema. So I would therefore say, and I'm taking a little bit of a leap now, but I think this is true, Shema is something which is a statement of the Shechina appearing. Okay, let me say it even clearer. What do you say when you say Shema? Shema is Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. It is an absolute statement of the most profound direct declaration of God that we can possibly say. Why do you cover your eyes when you say Shema? So you're going to tell me, so you have more Kavana. You need Kavana in other places in davening also. Is that according to, again, certain sources, when you say the Shema, the Shechina is right there. And it's so strong that you have to close your eyes. It's as if, you know, you can say that it's such a moment of intimacy that when somebody kisses, then they close their eyes. Shema, you have to close your eyes because it's too strong. The Shechina is right there. And what do you say right after you say the Shema? You say to God, I love you. It is a moment of total intimacy with God. And Yaakov therefore said the Shema at that moment after all these years of not having Nevuah, and now the Nevuah is back, and the statement to say is the Shema. Therefore, when Yaakov loses his clairvoyance, he loses the Nevuah again, what do his sons do? His sons say the Shema in order to bring back the Shechina, in order to recreate it. And at that point, maybe it even works, because we see Yaakov does see some things, and Yaakov says, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus Olam Vayed. When do we say Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus Olam Vayed? We said in the Beis HaMikdash. At which point do you say it? You say it when the Kohen Gadol says the Shem Hashem, which means it's and that brings the Shechina into the room. The response to the Shechina is Baruch Shem. So therefore, this brings the Shechina. The response is Baruch Shem. It's there, but still, Yaakov doesn't reveal the end of days. And now let's go back to that, because I think that there's something much more profound there. There's a machloket in the Midrash what Yaakov sees. One says that he sees Melchemet Gog u'Magog. Another says he sees Bayit Shlishi. He sees a third Beit HaMikdash being built. Another, you know, he sees the end of days. So on the one hand, Yaakov wanted to tell them this. Let me put it like this. What's Yaakov really saying? Any of you people do this terrible, terrible thing when you read a book, you skip to the very end to see how it's going to end? You don't do this, right? It's not a nice thing to do. Yaakov wanted to tell him how the book is going to end. It's going to end okay. Spoiler alert. By the way, any of you didn't want to know this? Mamish, a spoiler alert. It's all going to work out okay at the end. But what's the problem? The problem is that it's just so many years in the future. Which means they didn't even start the Egyptian slavery yet. They didn't even, I mean, Moshe Rabbeinu was not even born yet. They didn't even leave yet. The first Beit, they didn't get into Eretz Yisrael. They didn't capture the first Beit. They didn't go into the first exile yet. They didn't get to come back to be the second one. They didn't go into the second exile yet. They didn't go through the Crusades. They didn't go through the pogroms. They didn't go through the Chmelnytsky massacres. And they didn't go through the Holocaust yet. They didn't come back. But what does Yaakov want to tell them? It's going to work out okay. This story has a happy ending. He just wants to, and God says, shh, shh. We can't tell everything right now. You're going to tell them it's going to work out okay at the very end of, you know, you're going to say, listen, don't worry, 4,000 years from now, it's all going to work out. Can you imagine how devastating that would be for them to know exactly how things are going to happen? Yaakov wanted to be Magalel Mekates. He wanted to tell them what's going to happen at the end. And God says, you know what? Don't tell them. It's better off not. But as I said, we know what he wanted to say. That's what the Medrash tells us. We know what he wanted to say. He wanted to tell them what's going to happen at the end. It is going to work out okay. So I'm saying, if I ruined the whole story for you just now, then I really apologize. But that's the end of the book. The end of the book, not this book, by the way. The end of the book is that everything's going to work out, and Mashiach is going to come, and the third base of Mikdash is going to be built, and it's all going to work out. And that's what Yaakov wanted to say. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, a little too much detail right now. Let's let them go through this. They didn't even start the first Gullus yet. We're going to tell them about the final Geula. Let's leave that. So therefore, it's not that Yaakov lost his Nevuah because any of his children were not okay. It wasn't because that he wasn't okay. It was because there are certain things that God, it's Kvod Hashem Hister Davar. Certain things don't need to be revealed at certain times. Kadosh Baruch Hu said, wait a minute. I don't want you to reveal this yet, and that's why Yaakov loses Nevuah. But the children, they all say Shema. By the way, the Targum Yonasan tells the whole story here right on the Pasuk, but he tells it in Aramaic. So how do you say Baruch Shem Kvod Malchus Olam Vayed in Aramaic? That's what it quotes. You never figure that out. So he tells the whole story right over here. So again, the next time you say Baruch Shem, the next time you say Yehei Shmei Rab, realize that that's what Yaakov Avinu says at that point, because now he realized, again, that is Kabbalah Somach Shemaim. To say Yehei Shmei Rab and Baruch is Kabbalah Somach Shemaim. That's what Yaakov says at that particular point. And I don't know what language he spoke. What do you think? He spoke Aramaic? He spoke Yiddish. So we'll continue next week.